We are delighted to have with us Madison West High School. Would those students please stand? Good. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. It's a national award-winning program. All the high schools in the state are invited to attend an oral argument, and if the school agrees to send students, then the students are given briefs of the case they're about to hear. And these class may or may not do a variety of activities surrounding this case. And then as part of this program, the students will meet at noon with a justice of this court, and there will be a discussion of the procedures of the court in hearing cases. There will not be a discussion of the substantive issues involved in the case. Anyone who wishes may join the students, and the presentation will be after our second case this morning. The noon presentation will be made by Justice Wilcox, who is making a dramatic entry at the moment. You're up, but Justice Wilcox has a cold, and if he's not up to it, one of us will substitute. We really can't substitute, but we're going to do the best we can. That's Justice Wilcox. Seated next to Justice Wilcox is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Patience Robensack. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With all the introductions made, we'll now call the first case, which is 03-1794, Dane County versus Kenneth R. McGrew. Arguing on behalf of Mr. McGrew is Attorney Rex Andered. Counsel?
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court and Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Rex Andreg, and I represent the defendant appellant petitioner in this case, Kenneth McGrew. The issue before this Court is, did Article 1, Section 5 of the Wisconsin Constitution guarantee Mr. McGrew the right to a 12-person jury trial in his civil forfeiture action? And this issue can be broken down, I think, into two sub-issues. First, did Article 1, Section 5 apply to his case in the first place? And second of all, if so, did it guarantee him a 12-person jury as opposed to a 6-person jury? As I was reading the respondents' briefs in preparation for this case, it struck me that in some respects, they have collectively conceded these sub-issues. For example, the Attorney General, in pointing out that Wisconsin's first set of statutes did provide for jury trials for minor offenses, including forfeiture cases, was willing to admit the possibility that there is a right to a jury trial, but argued that it would only be a 6-person jury. The county, on the other hand, conceded that if the right to a jury trial existed in this case, it would have to be a jury of 12 persons, but argued that no such right exists in the first place. I point this out because I think it illustrates there is strong support in the law for both propositions that the petitioner arguably or understandably has the burden of establishing in this case. And I would like to tackle the first tackle the issue pertaining to the number of jurors, because I think it's more easily answered. There's a good reason why the county concedes that any action covered under Article 1, Section 5 is entitled to a 12-person jury. And that's because based on the decisions of this court, way back beginning with Norville versus Rice, but even ending more recently with the Hansford decision, demonstrates that there's a strong tradition in this state of a 12-person jury. Whenever this court has addressed Article 1 and Section 5, it has consistently said that provision provides for a 12-person jury. The state, however, argues that even if the person is constitutionally entitled to a 12-person jury, then is even constitutionally entitled to a jury trial, that it would only be a 6-person jury. And its position appears to be based on early statutes which allowed certain cases to be tried to the justice of the peace along with a 6-person jury. And my first observation with regard to these early statutes is that they pertain to justice of the peace courts, which were somewhat forerunners of the municipal courts. And they weren't courts of record, which is a point that Norville took pains to make in its decision. The present case, however, is not a municipal court case, but it was a circuit court case and a case which took place in a court of record. Therefore, the argument that Norville would not be applicable to this case because it declined to discuss justice of the peace courts is not terribly persuasive because this case, like Norville, took place in a court of record, a court of last resort for the determination of factual issues, which is the primary function.
Counsel, do you think that that's a legitimate distinction between courts of record and courts that are not courts of record? I mean, should we really decide the case on that kind of a distinction?
Well, I think it's a legitimate distinction because, first of all, I know that the language in Norville, and I just want to quote this language, and I think I'll focus more in on your question, but the quote from Norville is, "But it is certain that when our Constitution was adopted, we had no court of record in existence in Wisconsin in which the number of the jury for jury trials of facts in any case, except by consent, could be less than 12. And so Norville did point out that it was a court of record that this case took place in and declined to discuss a court that was not of record, which was the Justice of Peace Court. And so I do believe that was an important distinction, and I think this is the reason why. It's the last, when you're in a court of record, it's the last opportunity that you have to have your facts adjudicated. And it's a court where there's going to be a record established of what facts are at issue in your case. And it's those facts upon which higher courts are going to have to apply the law and make determinations of legal issues. And so I think there is something unusually and special about a court of record that would make it important that if the right to a jury trial exists, it would have to be in that court. And the courts that are not of record, which are the lower courts, are courts which I think traditionally have been used more as a filter to relieve a burden on the higher courts of record. And so I do think that the distinction is important. The second observation that I would make with regard to the argument that these early statutes suggest that it could be a 6-person jury is that there is also somewhat of a tradition in constitutional jurisprudence that a right may be denied at one stage, a constitutional right, so long as there is an opportunity to exercise that right at a later stage. And I think of some of the cases that involve due process and taking cases where they say you may not get a pre-deprivation hearing, but that may be okay as long as you get a post-deprivation hearing. Those original statutes, which provided only for 6-person juries and justice of the peace court, those same statutes also provided for an appeal to the county court, where importantly they also, an individual was guaranteed a jury trial. And there was an effort by the legislature to make those county courts 6-person juries as well, but that effort failed, and it failed when this court in the Norville case ruled that a 6-person jury at that level would be unconstitutional. And so by 1850, all defendants really who were charged with minor offenses, justice of the peace courts, did have access to a 12-person jury through the county court system if they didn't prevail in the court of first impression.
How does this stand up under the village food two-prong test, which goes back and talks about the fact that did this exist in 1848?
Well, I've indicated briefly that I have some concerns about the village food analysis, and naturally we're bound by that. My belief is that the words remains inviolate in the language of the Constitution goes to the manner in which the jury trial is to be conducted, how many jurors you're supposed to have, and more to the substance of that right, and really was not meant to apply to suggest what cases, to which cases the right would extend, and that the cases to which it was meant to extend are expressed by the words which come right after that in the provision, and shall extend to all cases at law. And that, therefore, to read into the words remain inviolate, the idea that it sort of cemented a finite set of causes of action, sets that that provision on a course of interpretation of, I think, perhaps decreasing relevance. And that to avoid that problem, you have to take the most liberal reading of that decision and look not to the specific cause of action, but rather what kind of cause of action are we talking about, in this case, civil forfeiture. And so then the question becomes, well, how were civil forfeitures handled back then? And we know...
But were traffic violations always civil forfeitures?
Well, I think there was a time when traffic violations were not civil forfeitures and they were looked at as criminal cases. But since that time, they have become civil forfeiture cases, and so...
I guess the reason I ask the question is if we're supposed to interpret the Constitution based upon the laws that existed at the time the Constitution was adopted, I'm trying to get a handle on which law we focus on. Do we focus on the fact that at the time the traffic laws were created, they were criminal, or do we focus on the fact that they're currently civil forfeitures?
Well, we didn't really have the traffic laws at the time that the Constitution was created, and of course that's part of the quandary in which we all find ourselves in trying to deal with this strange animal that's a civil forfeiture case that at one time was criminal and then they talked about it being quasi-criminal. And I think that we need to focus on how those cases are viewed today, because today is the day that we're applying and making the decision as to what that provision means and what it means for today. If at some point in time things were to change and the traffic laws were, say, to become criminal again and the legislature decided to make them criminal, then whatever decision the court makes based on Article 1, Section 5 would be relevant perhaps or just instructive at that time, and we'd have to review the applicability or the right to a jury trial in those cases under a different article. But they're civil today, and I think that's what we need to focus on.
Could I ask, is Mr. McGrew charged with violating a county ordinance?
He was charged with violating a county ordinance.
Were there ordinances back in 1848?
Well, there weren't. There certainly weren't county ordinance violations, to my knowledge. I know there were some local rules. I don't know that they would have been county ordinances per se.
So really, would it be fair to say that the county had no authority to create an ordinance until it was authorized to do so by the legislature?
I think that would be fair to say that the county had no authority to create an ordinance until the legislature granted it that power.
So counties didn't have really home rule power in the way that, say, cities did.
Not in 1848.
All right. So does that make any difference here?
I don't think that it makes any difference, because I think what we really what really makes a difference is that the fact that it's a civil case. I mean, I think that's sort of the main thing that we need to focus on. And once again, I take Village Food, and my belief is that it needs to be read in a rather liberal fashion, and that we need to focus on what type of case we have, that really what's going to determine the applicability of this constitutional provision is not so much where the authority came to grant the provision upon which the action is based, but what is the nature of the case? What is the essence of the case? Because that, in essence, will tell us where we need to look in the Constitution to determine.
Counselor, but don't we really have to look a little more carefully than just the type of case it is? Don't we have to examine under Village Foods the substantive characteristics of the case that's at issue?
Well, under the village food analysis, and that's why I keep coming back to this idea that I think to make that case a case that has some staying power in terms of the future of interpretation of the Constitution, that it needs to be liberally and construed. To the extent that you want to look more at the actual substantive elements of the particular offense, then that puts us in a position of pointing out that, there were some quasi-traffic-type forfeitures or violations back at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, but then we're talking about carriages and horses and that kind of thing. And if you do look at cases over the years, there have been a number of cases which have drawn that analogy. Basically what Village Food tells us is that we need to look at what the common law was at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. And different environments evolved different applications of trial by jury and its limits. And so if you go back and you look at the common law in England, you find, I think, that there was a movement to a certain extent away from the jury and towards the justices of the peace in cases. And then when you look at the colonies, they were less tolerant of summary proceedings and less trustful of the justice of the peace. And they didn't go quite as far as England did, but there were certain areas where they did allow cases to be tried without a jury.
Counsel, following up on Justice Rodensack's comment and her question having to do with Village Foods and whether or not you look at the substance of what was involved, it occurred to me that there's a line of cases that nobody discussed in the briefs, and those are cases involving whether there is or is not a right to trial by jury in a juvenile case. There are two decisions from this court, in the interest of N.E. and in the interest of Hezier, and those cases said there was no right to trial by jury, and it looked at whether or not there were juvenile proceedings in effect in 1848. And, of course, there were not. And, therefore, there was no right to trial by jury. Now, in this situation, and I think it's consistent with Village Foods, in this situation, there were not motor vehicle forfeiture cases existing in 1848. Isn't that significant here when we look at the substance of the action that we're dealing with?
Well, I would say that the juvenile cases, in essence, sort of support the interpretation that I'm advancing on the Village Food case because, again, they were saying that it was the type of proceeding, and that's sort of a broad category of a proceeding, and I don't recall the specifics of what the particular juvenile was charged with in those cases. But the idea was that because there were no juvenile proceedings per se, broad type of category juvenile proceedings back in 1848, then we can't go back and we can't find that category of case. Whereas I think if you look at this from a perspective of motor vehicle cases, as I stated before, then you're put into a situation, or we are, of trying to analogize motor vehicles to horse-drawn carriages. And I think that analogy works because of the broad and liberal interpretation I'm advancing. But I don't look at this as a motor vehicle case as much as I look at it as a civil forfeiture case, and I think civil forfeiture is a category just as juvenile proceedings are.
Well, in the juvenile cases, the other side of the coin could have been, and I think probably was,
that juveniles could be charged in criminal court when they violated the law before there was a separate juvenile court system set up or a children's court system set up. And it seems to me that's very comparable to this situation. You're saying, well, okay, you know, horse-drawn carriages, those matters could have been charged and often were charged in county courts. And yet now we're talking about not, you know, horseless carriages. We're talking about motor vehicle violations. And it seems to me that's a totally different category, one very analogous to the juvenile court dichotomy.
Is your, and I'm not sure that I understood your position on the juvenile type cases. Are you saying that back in 1848 that juveniles could be charged with crimes?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Sure. They didn't have a separate court system, if you will, for juveniles. That was created in Wisconsin, if I remember right, about 1898 or somewhere in that range at least, around the turn of the century. And the same thing appears to me to be true here. Motor vehicle allegations, forfeitures, criminal charges, whatever you want to call them, didn't exist in 1848, but only existed when the automobile was invented and laws begin to develop in regard to motor vehicles. So it seems to me that's a very analogous situation.
Well, I would keep coming back to the idea that the juvenile, and I, with all due respect to your position, that the juvenile system is more than just a substantive type of crime that somebody may be charged with or an offense that somebody may be charged with, but really represents a whole new system with a whole new set of procedures and a whole new set of rights, and there's a whole new set of decisions that have been decided that pertain to the juvenile justice system. And it's something that I think would be hard to go back to the time of the adoption of the Constitution and say that we had that kind of system or those kinds of cases adjudicated back then, whereas it's not quite that type of a reach when you talk about civil forfeiture cases, because the framers of the Wisconsin Constitution were not unfamiliar with the concept of government prosecuting its citizens in an effort to obtain a forfeiture from them. And Wisconsin really, at that time, when you look at the common law, and I was saying before that you look at England, you look at the colonies, and they're a little much more tolerant of, or less tolerant, rather, of the summary proceedings. I think what matters most here is what Wisconsin's common law was at the time, that the territory that would become Wisconsin, what was the common law back then. And juries were widely used in Wisconsin. You see references to them even in the 1839 Territorial Acts, and we have this impassioned defense of the right to a jury trial at the Wisconsin Convention.
Counsel, realizing that and playing off Justice Crook's question, he's focusing on the type or substance being that of a juvenile jury trial. You want to be much wider, and you want to go civil forfeitures. Well, I'll take the Goldilocks approach in the middle. Maybe I'll be just right. And let's look at the law of the road. And this is set forth in the state's brief. And their argument is, look, there were, as we know, rules of the road. And the rules of the road that existed at the time of statehood in 1849, they cite specifically some legislation, dealt with, as you say, carriages, and but nevertheless, rules of the road. And they make the point that the amount of money involved in those kinds of violations for rules of the road would put it into justice of the peace, where they would have a six-person jury. And so that, they posit, is the answer, that even if there is a right, the right only is to a six-person jury when you look at what kind of case this is, rules of the road cases. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, they would be entitled to a six-person jury. But I would come back to the fact that First of all, those rules are important because they indicate that cases that involve rules of the road were entitled to jury trials, but there were only six persons. However, you also did have the right, if you did not prevail in that original court with a six-person jury, to appeal your case to a county court. And you had a right to have a jury trial there, too. And although the statutes originally stated that you would only get six persons again at the higher level, it was that precise provision of the statutes that this court ruled unconstitutional in Norville versus Rice. So very early on in this state's existence, and by the time this case was decided in 1853, anybody who violated the rules of the road under the statutory scheme, along with this court's interpretation, had a right to a 12-person jury.
But you're hanging your head on the court of record issue. Is that pretty much where you're going with this?
Well, I'm not hanging my hat only on that, but I am hanging a hat on, one of my hats on that.
And I guess the reason I want to follow up on Justice Crook's question earlier, then how do you distinguish the juvenile situation where there you're dealing with courts of record, yet there's no right to a jury trial because the right to a jury trial didn't exist at the time the Constitution was created?
I'm not hanging my hat only on the courts of record issue to the extent that I believe that in every court of record you're entitled to a jury trial. Because as we know, probate courts and foreclosure actions and so forth take place in courts of records, and there's no question those are equitable remedies. You don't have a right to a jury trial there. I would answer the question, I guess, the same way that I answered it before, in that the juvenile proceeding takes place in a court of record. You don't get a jury trial in that case, just like you don't in a foreclosure proceeding that takes place in a court of record. The reason being is we didn't have that system. We didn't have that type of system in place back at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, whereas we did have civil forfeiture actions that included rules of the road and so forth. And Wisconsin really has a tradition, unlike a lot of other states, not just of having justices of peace without a jury decide cases, but having justices of the peace decide cases with a jury. And that tradition is reflected in the language. And if the language of this provision had only said the right to a jury trial shall remain inviolate, and it stopped there, then I think you could say that the framers intended not only that the substance of the right would remain as it is, but that also the cases to which it would extend would sort of remain cemented in place. But after stating that the right would remain inviolate, they went on to establish to what cases it would extend by saying it would extend to all cases at law. And in terms of some arguments of whether a petty offense might not be entitled to a jury trial, I think you also have to note that they said that it would be without regard to the amount in controversy, and they must have known that the United States Constitution had placed limits on the exercise of that right in those cases, and they rejected those limitations in Wisconsin.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Jason Hansen, Assistant District Attorney of Madison, arguing on behalf of Dane County.
May it please the Court, I am Jason Hansen. I'm an Assistant District Attorney, and I represent Dane County in this matter. Justices, there are two main points that the county has for the Court's consideration, and they have been discussed to some extent already this morning. The first is that there is no constitutional right to a jury trial in a civil traffic case because the cause of action didn't exist at statehood. And the second is that if the Court would conclude that some comparable cause of action existed at statehood, it would have been handled summarily, most likely, or with a six-person jury at most, and therefore under Village Food, the right should be frozen as it did exist at the time of statehood. I guess a couple of small but important points I want to make before I turn to the major points. The first, it was with respect to Section 75606, sub 2 sub c of the statutes. In our briefs, we had some discussion about that statute, and I want to make it clear that it's the county's position that that statute confers no right to a jury trial of any sort. It simply specifies, and I quote, whenever an issue is to be tried before a jury, the jury is to be a jury of six. There is, of course, a statutory right to a six-person jury trial in the proceeding that was part of this action, pursuant to Section 345.43. The second small thing I guess I want to point out is simply that I don't think that if the court were to hold true to Ogden and Village Food, those lines of cases, that it can answer the question as broadly as the question was presented in the grant of the petition. The grant of the petition talked in general about civil forfeiture cases, and I'm not sure that if we stick with the Village Food paradigm that you can answer it in that regard, at least that broadly.
What is the question you think we ought to ask and answer?
Well, I think that there's sufficient information before the court and there is a sufficient background such that the court can answer the question of whether there is the right, constitutional right, that is, to a jury in ordinance or other forfeiture actions related to traffic offenses. And I guess I get there by...
Does it matter if it's a city ordinance or a county ordinance?
Or even a state forfeiture. And I get there because there are the two sort of intertwined but related lines of cases. There's the Ogden case and the Village Food line of cases.
What do they stand for in your view?
Well, they're both based on the non-existence of the right to a jury at the time of the Constitution, but the Ogden case and line of cases focuses more on remedy. They simply say no right to a jury in an ordinance violation, regardless of the subject matter, whereas Village Food focuses less on the remedy involved and more on the specific subject matter of the violation. In this case, I think...
But in this case, we have a statute giving you a jury right. And in this case, the only issue is a 6 or 12.
The constitutional issue... Well, the issue constitutionally might be 0, 6, or 12, depending on how...
You have a statutory right?
To 6, clearly.
Okay. So if we say it's constitutional, then what do you do? Strike down the whole statute and substitute 12 for 6? What does the court do?
If the court were to rule that the right is constitutional in nature, then it would be my position that you look to what the practice would have been in an ordinance violation or a case of this sort at the time of statehood. And I think when one looks at that, it's extremely likely that this would have been handled in a summary fashion. Therefore, the constitutional right essentially was to not have a right. The backup position, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, would be that at most these sort of cases would have been handled in justice court by six-person juries. We know that in justice court cases were only heard by 12-person juries in very limited cases involving forcible entry and detainment. So at most it would have been 6, and that would be then the constitutional right would be 6 if the court were to find that this would not have simply been a summary proceeding at common law prior.
Your position, it's not a constitutional right. The statute gives you 6. That's what you get.
That is my position, yes.
Counsel, how do you interpret in the constitutional provision the last sentence, which says, provided, however, that the legislature may from time to time by statute provide that a valid verdict in civil cases may be based on the votes of a specified number of the jury, not less than 5/6 thereof.
Certainly a reasonable interpretation of that language was that those who passed that constitutional amendment or that amendment to the original constitutional provision had envisioned six-person juries. They certainly could have used the language not less than 10 had they been thinking of 12-person juries. I do think it has to be conceded by the county, though, that there were in place six-person juries at that point, and it might have been that the intention was not to sort of tip the apple cart in that regard.
I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure I understand your answer. Are you saying 5-6 means that they intended that there be six-person jury if authorized by statute and 5 votes are enough? If you're doing that, then my question is, if you have a 12-person jury, is 10 enough if you really mean 5 out of 6?
Well, it would have been sort of a strange – knowing that there were, in fact, six-person juries that occurred during that time period, it would have been sort of strange for them to use the language 10-12ths. So 5-6 is the lowest common denominator.
Right. I know that.
I have no doubt. But Chief Justice, I guess – The response to Justice Bradley's question would be that had it been intended that that language meant something other than 5-6, it certainly could have been phrased not less than 10, which would have been a way of expressing the 5-6 concept or the 10-12 concept without making it wrongly worded.
No, because 5-6 can apply to a 6-person jury or a 12-person jury.
Sure. That's true.
So that's why you would use 5-6. And there are some times where there might be a six-person jury, but under the old common law, you always needed jury unanimity, I thought. So this changes not the number of jurors, but the unanimity of jurors. And it's only in the civil jury instruction provision, not the criminal jury instruction provision.
At a minimum.
Jury instruction, but jury.
At a minimum, it was certainly not a constitutional repudiation of the idea of a six-person jury. It's hard to know how much emphasis to put on that, and in fact, I think in the county's brief, we really referred to that language in a footnote, because it is sort of tough to know what to make of that 5-6 language.
Did you have the opportunity to at all investigate what that amendment intended?
I tried. I didn't have much success finding much of a legislative history, to the extent that it would be legislative history, on that provision.
Is usually a sort of short description of what is intended in a constitutional amendment.
Right. I do know historically there was a line of cases preceding that amendment that discussed the question of whether a jury had to be unanimous in a civil proceeding. And that's why I think one reasonable read of it is that it was intended to deal with the unanimity issue. It's why I'm not, to use the analogy, it's why I'm not hanging any of my hats on that.
You indicated that there were six-person juries at the time the Constitution was adopted in 1848. Were there six-person juries in effect at the time Article 1, Section 5 was amended in the early 20s?
There were, and I'm basing that on case law that came out prior to that. There were a number of reported cases that the 6 versus 12 issue wasn't a central issue in the case, but the reports indicate that there were six-person juries in place during that period of time.
Probably in juvenile cases, for example.
Well, the ones I saw were more in the classic civil lawsuit-type setting. The
counsel, how do you answer what opposing counsel has talked about? And that's the distinction between what was going on in Justice of the Peace courts, which were not courts of record, and the county courts, which were courts of record.
Well, I think that is answered really on the face of both the Ogden line of cases as well as Village Food, in that in each of those cases, the emphasis is on what the right was at the time of the Constitution. I don't know that the fact that subsequently, there were amendments made where we eliminated Justice of the Peace courts get to the point of saying that somehow a right is created by virtue of that being eliminated. I don't see the distinction between whether it's a Justice of the Peace court or a circuit court as being particularly important in determining whether somebody has a constitutional right to a six-person jury.
If I could follow up on Justice Crook's question, then how do you deal with the language that was cited earlier from Norville versus Wright, where the court says, but it is certain that when our Constitution was adopted, we had no court of record in existence in Wisconsin in which the number of the jury for trials of facts in any case except by consent could be less than 12.
I don't deny the truth of that statement. I couldn't deny the truth of that statement. But I do know that the Norville court specifically then went on to say, but we do have a historical tradition of having six-person jury trials in Justice of the Peace Court.
But those are not courts of record.
They were not courts of record. I agree. All right. But then the question is, does it matter ultimately? Does it make any difference? And that sort of gets into the issue raised by counsel with respect to whether at a higher level do you have the right. I guess what I would say in response to that specifically is that in the Lloyd case, which is cited in the briefs, one of the issues was whether on an appeal to the circuit court level, either circuit or county court at that point, I can't recall which, on an appeal to the next level, would there be a right to a jury trial in this court? In that case, said that there would not. And obviously, this court was aware that there would not be the right to a jury anywhere above county or circuit court. So this court has in the past rejected the approach that the right has to exist somewhere higher up. The counsel's argument, I think, in that regard comes a little bit from some language in Ogden as well. But Ogden also goes on to discuss for a great length of time, and Ogden's now over a century old, but it goes on to discuss for a great length of time the historical prevalence of summary proceedings in relatively minor cases, both in the United States and in the U.K.
Counsel, I want to follow up on the Noval or Norval language cited by Justice Butler. As I read that case and the paragraphs surrounding the quoted language, I read the case as indicating the court saying, hey, look, when it comes to the size of jury before justice of the peace, we're not going to touch that issue, so we're not going to address it. Oh, but we do note, however, that there is a right of appeal to go to the county court, the court of record, where a trial by a jury of 12 men would be available. The next paragraph after that seems to me, arguably, to state, and in the county court, which is a court of record, there is a jury of 12, and that is part of the what's been adopted before, that's what existed before the adoption of the Constitution, and that remains inviolate. What's wrong with my reading of this 1853 case, you know, so close to statehood?
Well, I think the way I understood your reading of that case, it was giving some justice to the remain inviolate language of Article I, Section 5.
Well, I meant it to say that, look, in a county court, there is 12-person jury, and that is required under the constitutional provision of your right to jury remaining inviolate. As applied to the justice of the peace, interesting question whether or not they can have just six. But we won't address it. But we do note, ultimately, they have the ability to have 12 because they can remove the case to county court.
I guess my response is that in the 150-something years since Norval, this court has routinely interpreted the remain inviolate language and, in fact, the language in Norval to mean that, and that goes up through Village Food and continues, to mean that we're concerned with the right as it existed at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. As Justice Crooks pointed out earlier with respect to juvenile proceedings, this Court has found that there is no right in juvenile proceedings. This Court has found that there's no right in agency review determinations with respect to workman's comp claims, guardianship actions, a number of things that really in the lives of people on an everyday basis are significant compared to a traffic citation.
It may be too broad to say there's no constitutional right to a jury in delinquency, because in HESI, where the juvenile might be subject to being adjudicated delinquent but incarcerated in an adult correctional facility, there was a jury trial right in that case, as I understand the case. And the issue of whether you have a right to jury trial, the court recognizes that you don't have to exactly find that cause of action in 1848. Things have changed somewhat since then. And if you just looked at 1848 and did nothing there'd be a lot of causes of action that were not known in the law, or at least if someone had thought about it, they might have been known. So what you do is you analogize. I mean, that's what the court has done, right? How close is it?
Well, and I think that's right, and I think that that read is consistent with the village food paradigm. The thing is, in this case, counsel has conceded that there were no county ordinance violations at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. We don't have really any evidence that there were traffic violations, either vehicular or...
Oh, I can't believe there weren't some rules about horses, like letting them loose on the roads. There must have been a violation of something.
Well, the earliest ones cited by anyone in any of the briefs were from the first legislature after the adoption of the Constitution. It's not entirely impossible, and I think it's probably likely, that those sort of situations prior to the adoption of the Constitution were dealt with more in the nuisance fashion rather than through an actual forfeiture or penalty-based offense.
You know, but a forfeiture is just a municipal, and that's, I'm using that broadly, asserting its right rather than an individual party asserting its right. I mean, if you're going to analogize, right? And you were asked, is it different whether it's county or city in terms of what the court ought to say? And you said it didn't matter. And yet there was at least an agreement between Justice Prosser and opposing counsel that there were no county ordinances and the county did not have, and I don't know this for a fact, I'm accepting it, didn't have statutory right to adopt ordinances. But you had home rule for a city, and so you may have had city ordinances in 1848.
I guess if we're going to analogize this cause of action to what was in place at that point, then it would suggest that all of these sort of rules of the road offenses were essentially nuisance actions prior to the adoption of the Constitution, which would mean there wasn't.
Does that help us? I mean, did you get a jury in a nuisance action?
It helps because nuisance actions were equitable. And it's clear, both on the language of Article 1, Section 5, as well as all of the cases interpreting it, that in an equitable action, there is no constitutional right. It extends to cases at law.
Mr. Hansen.
Yes, sir.
I'm not clear on this. Why is court of record important?
I don't know that it is.
Oh.
Isn't it?
The Constitution talk about court of record?
Not to my knowledge. The Constitution, as Your Honor is aware from the concurrence in the Huebner case that was written by Your Honor, is aware that the Constitution has various provisions on their face calling for justice of peace courts to hear certain actions, including what we would consider somewhat serious criminal matters. But the courts, I don't think the Constitution specifically uses the court of record language. As I indicated earlier, I don't see there being a great distinction between the court of record or non-record issue.
I'll tell you what the problem for me is, and it does dovetail with the question raised by Justice Prosser, and it's the Norvile opinion, which has, in one paragraph, emphasizes this is a court of record that we're dealing with, and then the next paragraph, and to me, it says, the right of a trial by jury of 12 persons. We therefore hold that when the defendant in the court below, which was the court of record, was denied a trial by a jury consisting of 12 men, he was deprived of a right secured to him by the Constitution. The whole argument was there was a statute that said you could have 6 persons in the court of record, and in 1853, they struck down that statute that said you could have a 6-person jury trial in a court of record because in 1853, they said the right of a trial in a court of record meant 12.
Though if one looks at the Norval case, that was an action that I think under any reading of the village food test at this point would have allowed a constitutional right. I guess I don't put the emphasis on the court of record language in that decision as much as I do on the the nature of the cause of action in that particular case, which was an action essentially for debt, which I think clearly at this point is something that we would understand as being an action at law, an action for which somebody was entitled to a constitutional jury prior to the adoption of the Constitution.
I think perhaps the emphasis on court of record or not court of record is this. You might be able to provide a summary proceeding in a, not in a court of record. I'm sorry, in a court that is not a court of record by giving the parties the opportunity to do it again in a court of record. So you might have a very summary proceeding. You might have six persons. And if you complain, hey, I got a right to a jury trial, the answer is, sure, and you can get one. You go through this process first, and then you get a jury trial.
I guess the response is to essentially say three cases. The first is Ogden and the line of cases that follow Ogden. Ogden, well, it sort of raised that issue as a teaser, and that's the teaser that's been thrown out in the briefs by counsel. Ogden took the position it did, which is no right in an ordinance violation, without regard. It cited cases from all over the place that were without regard to whether there was a higher right elsewhere. There's discussion specifically in Ogden about the ability of municipalities, specifically in that case, to police its citizens by having summary, fast processes to deal with wrongdoers in communities. Then there's Gaston, which talked about there not being a right at all because there was no right at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. And in Gaston, there was certainly no opportunity for a right to a jury trial in a higher court, and the same would be true of the Lloyd decision. Navarro is an interesting case. It's a case that certainly, because it's early, is an important case, and I think it's been read perhaps a little bit more broadly than what's warranted, particularly in light of the Court's more recent pronouncements on the meaning of Article 1, Section 5.
Yeah, but isn't Norvell more important than anything we might say? Far be it for me to confess that. Because you've got it by people, and I don't know, I didn't go back to look and see if Crawford was in the Constitutional Convention, but it's an 1853 case. The people who argued the case and the judges who sat on that court come from the background. I mean, they were there.
They were also the same people that passed the statute.
That's right. The whole bit. And then declared it unconstitutional.
But importantly, did not declare unconstitutional the six-person juries in the Justice of the Peace Court. I don't think that the county's position asks the court to do anything more than to do justice to the language remain inviolate. And I think that language has been interpreted since Norville and in Norville itself to mean the right as it existed at the time of the Constitution.
It is possible for a court to make a wrong decision, isn't it?
Not this court, but
talking about the 1853 court.
Yes, it is.
We can go back and find court decisions that say a party cannot waive the right to a jury trial when that provision is explicitly set out in the Constitution. I don't see how you could possibly say that court decision from this court was correct.
But in your honor, certainly routinely courts overrule themselves over time. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, you made a rather eloquent concurrence in the Huebner case with respect to the propriety of the Hansford decision. And I'm not here to litigate Hansford. Hansford deals with the right in a criminal proceeding, which I think is different and now appears to be settled.
That's a wise choice also not to argue that.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
You don't want us to overrule Hansford right now, do you?
I'm here to represent the county in a speeding violation. A can of worms I care not to open, but I do think that Justice Prosser's concurrence in the Huebner case, which was admittedly critical of the Hansford decision, does have some appeal, and it has some relevance to the proceedings before the court today.
The Hansford opinion, of course, being a unanimous opinion of this court. You recognize that?
Well, I do recognize that, though it was a unanimous opinion of the court specifically dealing with criminal issues, where I think it is clear that for a lengthy period of time, with the exception of potentially the Justice of Peace Courts, that there were 12 persons in the U.S. and in England.
Okay, I'll bite. You want us to overrule Norville?
I don't know that you have to overrule Norville in order to rule in the county's favor in this case. I would suggest that you don't. If Norville has been overruled, or if Norville is to be overruled, it already has been, essentially, by the village food test and by the cases that lead up to village food, in my view.
If I could just say, we presume that statutes passed by the legislature are constitutional, that that's an article of faith. The Norville court didn't seem to go through that analysis.
That's true. And I think that really brings up what I'd like to raise as a final point, which is, as a prosecutor, I usually hate arguments about burden of proof, because usually those come against me by defense attorneys. But the fact of the matter is there is a burden of proof issue in this case, and it is the appellant in this case, or the petitioner, rather, who is asserting that the statute at issue here is unconstitutional. In order to prove that it is, he must do so beyond a reasonable doubt, and I think to do so, he must also prove the underlying facts beyond a reasonable doubt. And I guess to conclude, I'd indicate that it's at least the county's position that hasn't occurred in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Renrick, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counselor, I'd like you to start by addressing the last comments of your opponent on burden of proof and how you have met it in regard to proving the underlying facts you need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt and how you have proven the statute that was applied to your client unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think that we've met the burden because I think it's clear. I think Norville decision makes it rather easy for us to meet the burden in the sense that it's unequivocal that an individual is entitled in a civil case to a jury trial of 12 people, and that if that case took place in a court of record and was a case at law, they're entitled to a jury trial. And I think you can't deny that when you read that decision. In terms of whether the common law, if we look under the village food analysis of whether the common law entitled an individual in this type of case to a jury trial, I think it's clear that it did. I think it's clear that these types of forfeiture actions, which involved rules of the road, and as pointed out in the Attorney General's brief, at the time of the Constitution's adoption, those people were entitled to jury trials.
Why shouldn't we consider rules of the road violations way back there nuisances, like opposing counsel suggests?
Because they were dealt with, and I mean, you can call them what you want, but the fact of the matter is that they were adjudicated in Justices of the Peace Court with six-person juries, and that in top of that, an individual was entitled to an appeal to a county court and have entitled to request a 12-person jury. And so I think that the tradition that this state has in terms of these types of cases is a tradition of having them adjudicated by a jury and not just in a summary proceeding.
Mr. Andrig is one of the most active and highly regarded defense attorneys in the state. You must know whether there are other cases where people are asking for 12-person juries in these municipal ordinances. Are there?
Whether on a day-to-day basis there are other cases, whether there are a number
Is the McGrew case the only case in which a defendant is asking for a 12-person jury?
No, we've done it before in our practice. We have, I think, a few cases that are pending where we've requested a 12-person jury. And I think there are other criminal defense or defense attorneys across the state who are. I'm not aware of any floodgates that are ready to break open depending on this court's ruling, but it certainly has come up in the past. And I'd like to maybe, if I could, just spend the last couple of minutes that I have here stepping outside of the legal analysis, just for a moment, and talk about why I think this is an important issue. Anytime you bring more brain power to bear on an issue, the result is likely to be more just. You get a greater breadth of knowledge and experience, and I think you get a more reliable verdict. And in this case, I think, is probably a good example, because if there had been six more jurors in this case, perhaps one of them, and I won't go into the details of the facts, but if one of them had been able to do time over distance calculations to the extent the court is familiar with some of the factual issues here, this, I think, could have turned the jury into Mr. McGrew's favor in this particular case. And there are, I mean, the United States Supreme Court has recognized that the size of the jury does affect the reliability of the fact-finding procedure. There's the Brown versus Louisiana case where the court said that a decline in the size of the jury leads to less accurate fact-finding and a greater risk of convicting an innocent person. And the Ballou versus Georgia case where the court said that statistical studies suggest that the risk of convicting an innocent person rises as the size of the jury diminishes. And a result the fairest possible result in this case, we should strive to achieve the fairest possible result from top to bottom in the judicial system. And in these cases, it's more than just a forfeiture, although that is significant for a lot of people. But there is the possibility of being incarcerated for failure to pay. There's a possibility of loss of operating privileges, registration privileges that can lead to loss of employment, loss of income. People become exposed to criminal charges as a result of these, whether they be operating after revocations or OWIs. They show up in pre-sentence investigations, and they're relied upon by criminal courts in sentencing. So the vast majority of people come into contact with the criminal justice or the justice system through these types of actions, and I think it would send a strong message in terms of the fairness and integrity of the system if the court would grant our petition and rule in our favor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Dendereg, and thank you, Mr. Hansen, for your arguments today on yet another right to jury trial issue. That concludes our hearing in 03-1794, Dane County versus Grill. We'll take a few moments recess so those students who wish to leave may do so, and another group of students is coming into the courtroom.